Welcome everyone to today's discussion on artificial intelligence in IVDs. I'm joined today by Bethany Chung, a principal in the clinical and post-market practice at RQM Plus, where she specializes in supporting clinical and performance strategies for MDR and IVDR submissions. Bethany has a PhD in biomedical engineering with a background in development, validation, and clinical testing of AI-based diagnostic devices. Today, we're going to have a high-level overview of the artificial intelligence space and the impact on in vitro diagnostics. So let's jump right in. Bethany, what's the current state of play for AI? Can you tell me a little bit about that and any regulations and standards we should be aware of?
Yeah, so AI is really exploding in every sector. And when I say AI, I think of those products, those devices, those things on the market that are sort of based in artificial intelligence or machine learning. So, we're seeing it everywhere, and this includes medical devices and diagnostics. In fact, the FDA publishes a list of their AI ML-based medical devices that they've made positive final decisions on. So that means that they've been de novo accepted or 510K cleared or PMA granted. And if you could just put up the first graphic we have, Margot, you can really see how much it's grown over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So you can see that from about 1995 to 2015, so over that 20-year period, there were really less than 10 per year that were able to go on the market. But since about 2020, it's been over 100 a year.
Wow.
So this is huge growth, right? Like, from onesie twosie years up to over 100 a year, we can see that the AI ML based devices are really making a dent in the market, and especially in the US right now, but also in Europe and around the world. And if you could go to the next slide, we can see that a large majority of these are in the area of radiology. And I think that's a lot of the image processing devices that we're seeing. So they're entering into the diagnostic space, and just really making a huge dent in it. And of course, with this huge market share comes more regulation. As people understand these devices a little bit more, they understand the risks and the benefits to them. We're starting to put more regulation in place. More guidance in place on how to regulate these devices as well. Just in the last couple of months, we've seen a number of guidances worldwide. We've seen regulations come up. To be specific, the IEC 42001 came out last year, and that is on management systems for artificial intelligence. We also see the standard 34971, which came out last year, which is an application of the ISO 14971 risk standard, and its specific application to machine learning. So that those ML AI algorithms. In the EU space, we have the AI regulation coming out. There was a final agreement on it recently. So we're looking to see more finalization of that regulation and how it will impact the medical device industry. And then on the US side of things, the end of last year, we saw guidance on the PCCP. So those are those predetermined change control plans. While it's not specific to medical de or to AI and ML medical devices, it's going to make a huge impact on the AI devices that are evolving. So when I say evolving, I mean that they're not, val trained, validated, tested, and locked before they go on the market. As of right now, a majority, if not all, of those devices on that, FDA tally list are those locked devices. With the PCCP guidance, we now have a better indication of how to put these evolving devices on the market so that they can be, you know, perhaps learn patient-specific characteristics and, and just be more catered toward the individual patient.
Yeah, so it seems like we're really at a turning point in terms of the regulations being able to support these innovations.
We really are. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about how artificial intelligence comes into play for IVDs? How is it used within that space?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when talking about this today, I really wanted to look at five spaces that we want to watch in the future for these. The first
always love a list.
Yeah, I know, right? Top five is always popular. Mm-hmm. So the first I want to talk about is, you know, what we think of when we think of AI for IVDs. And those are those IVDs that are in and of themselves algorithms that, for all intents and purposes, make a diagnosis. So they'll take a bunch of inputs and output either a positive or negative diagnosis, whether someone has a condition or not, or they'll maybe provide information on disease staging. So these basically are IVDs that are using predictive algorithms rather than your traditional IVD assay that detects an analyte. These are more statistical based. So your algorithm will basically give you confidence, right? What is the statistical likelihood of this person being positive for this condition or negative for this condition?
Interesting. So, you know, when you're talking, it sounds like these are really just software devices. So where's that line? You know, how do we know whether a device should be classified as an in vitro diagnostic versus a medical device, like a software as a medical device? Where is that line and how do we know?
That's actually a really tricky question. And I'm not entirely sure that there is a solid line that separates them. If we start in the US, I think it's a simpler answer because generally speaking, IVDs are just a specific type of medical device. So they fall generally under the same regulation. There are specific guidances to follow within the FDA about how to regulate clinical decision support software. And I think that that's where most of these are falling. They're falling under that CDS software. There's a guidance on really how to categorize the risk of that software and specific ways of regulating it. So I think in the US, it's maybe a little bit more straightforward. In the EU, it's more difficult because, you know, declaring your device either a medical device or an IVD will actually put you, you know, under a completely different regulation. These would fall under medical device software, which is a term that is specifically defined for EU regulations. And there is an MDCG guidance, that's 2019-11, that helps you classify your software, not just as a medical device or an IVD, but also help you with that risk classification of it. So if it's an IVD, is it class A, B, C, or D? I really like the example that's given within this guidance as to this type of device that kind of gives you a diagnosis. So the example that's given is a software that takes a bunch of inputs and gives you the statistical predisposition for either trisomy 21 or trisomy 18. Now, what we want to look for here is what is the intended purpose of this device, of this software, and what are the inputs to this software? So the intended purpose is to give the likelihood of this patient having trisomy 21 and trisomy 18. What are the inputs? In this particular case, it says that the inputs are primarily coming from IVDs. So there is, you know, IVD testing that is going on, giving an output, and those are going as inputs into the software. Now I say primarily. Also, there could be some inputs from either just a clinical examination of the patient, the doctor's observations. In this example in particular, they talk about outputs or inputs coming from medical devices. So something like measurements of the neck fold or the nasal bone, but primarily they're coming from IVDs. And the intended purpose is driven from these IVDs. So in this case, it would be categorized as an IVD rather than a medical device. But, you know, really, it is very specific to the device itself. So it's hard to really categorize more broadly where it's going to be going.
Sure.
So another example that I like for this type of device comes in what's on the market right now is an ovulation kit. And that will actually, you know, take the, as inputs, it will take the output of, you know, urinalysis IVDs of specific hormones. So if a patient, you know, does a urinalysis over a number of days and the software will take the outputs from that urinalysis and predict the day that the patient ovulated. So that's something where clearly the inputs are all coming from IVDs. So this would also be categorized as an IVD. So these are just fun examples that will hopefully help guide people into determining whether their clinical decision support software will be in that IVD category or be kicked into the medical device category.
Great. Okay, so that was number one in our list of five, right? So
yeah,
what's
one.
Next? How else do we see these IVDs being used with artificial intelligence?
So the next space I wanted to talk about was still IVDs, but kind of taking a step back from the actual diagnosis. So these are IVDs that are aiding in the diagnostic workflow. Like we saw in the chart earlier, a lot of these AI-based medical devices are in the radiology sector. So I see a lot of examples of these devices that aid in diagnostic workflow being image processing devices. So an example of this is, you know, you take a tissue sample from a patient and it needs to go off to the pathologist for examination. What the software can do is actually, you know, look at the image of the slide and pick out hotspots, say, that the radiologist or the pathologist should be focusing on. So this is not necessarily making a diagnosis on its own. It's still relying on the pathologist for that final decision, but it's helping make their job a little bit easier, right? It's saying, forget the rest of the slide, just look at these particular parts, and we think that's where you should focus on to make that diagnosis. Another example is maybe there is a low resource setting where you can't get a lot of healthcare staff, or we're looking at something like an at-home testing kit where there's a result that could be difficult to interpret. So I'm thinking like a lateral flow assay that, you know, there has to be specific instructions on how dark the line needs to be, and how to interpret something like that. So that's another, you know, image processing example that we can look to. So if you, you know, do your traditional lateral flow assay, take a picture of it with your phone, and there's an app on your phone that will look at that and interpret that as a positive or negative diagnosis. It's just another image processing space that doesn't necessarily do the final diagnosis, but it aids in the workflow and interpretation of it.
Sure. Yeah. Would we also put like next-gen sequencing into this bucket like algorithms that interpret genetic testing data?
Yeah, we would, I think. And I think that's a really exciting space to keep watching as well, is that next-gen sequencing. I don't have an awful lot of experience with that, but it's really exciting and it's up and coming. And yeah. I am looking forward to see the developments that are made in that.
All right. Very interesting. So those first two examples are really, you know, artificial intelligence built into the IVD as part of the IVD. But, you know, that's not the only way that AI is being used in this space. So let's move on a little bit to how it can help support manufacturers and the other sorts of things we can use it for.
Yeah. So if we take a little step back from the actual IVD itself, what I think, and I think this is maybe the most exciting space for me at least, is using AI in the performance testing of these IVDs. And by that, I mean looking at in silico trials. So this may be a new term for some. You know, there are in vivo, in vitro, and now we're talking about in silico. So what are in silico trials? These are basically computer models that are simulations of the human body or part of the human body. And it can be as broad as an entire population. So that's something like maybe we look at population modeling and disease spread and the effect of a vaccine on a population. Then if we take it a step smaller and look at, you know, one specific human body model. There is a lot of research now going into something that's called the digital twin. So this is basically taking a patient and trying to capture, you know, the most important characteristics for the testing that you plan on doing. So looking at that patient's, you know, chemical characteristics of their blood, looking at certain flow characteristics, just, you know, whatever those pieces are that are most important that we can model and make a computer simulated version of this person that we can maybe try an IVD on or try a medical device on. I know that digital twin is really big in the pharmaceutical space right now. So it's really just looking at computer simulations, computer models, so that you don't need to do the testing on the person themselves. So it's a lower risk
right.
way of testing.
Have you seen this yet with IVDs, or this is like up and coming? Where do we sit?
Yeah, I think that it's taking off in pharma first, maybe in traditional medical devices second. And I have not seen a lot of use in IVDs yet. But I do think it is up and coming, just because of the cost savings, the lower risk for patients. It has all of these benefits to it, but also, you know, it has the risk of we're not actually looking at the patient themselves, right? Sure. There is always that tiny gap in knowledge that we have when we're doing a computer simulation.
Right. So maybe not replacing our pivotal trials, but earlier on in the development process, something like this might be useful.
Yeah, yeah. And I have seen a couple of really interesting examples of this. The first one actually goes way back to my graduate school days when I was working with an anesthesiologist. So the anesthesiologist I was working with is developing a virtual training lab for new residents. And I learned through this experience that one of the main jobs of the anesthesiologist at the beginning of surgery is to make sure that the patient has a patent airway. And a lot of that is physical manipulation. So the simulation lab that I was able to see had basically a head and torso, and built into that were sensors. So they're, you know, physical sensors, electrical sensors. There was a simulated ECG monitor, a few other physiological monitors as well. So the residents at the time, you know, could administer anesthesiology medications virtually, of course, and see how the patient responded to it. If the patient, the virtual patient body, was in a poor position, then that would give the appropriate physiological signals. And the anesthesiologist resident could learn to read those signals, make the physical adjustment on the body, and see, you know, from the signals, the reaction to that. So did that remedy the situation? Is the airway patent now? So it was really interesting to see kind of that combination of the computer and the physical simulation at the same time and used in that training setting. And then another one that I've seen more recently, and this kind of, you know, it brings in MD, it brings in medical devices, it brings in AI, it brings in cooperation between medical device manufacturers. So this is, on the market, there is an AI-based medical device that is a clinical decision support software. And it takes a number of lab results as inputs, and it outputs a prediction for organ survival of organ transplants. So this is post-transplantation, say about 6 months after the transplantation. You can take, you know, some of patient lab results, put it into the software, and the software will say, you know, at 5 years, we anticipate a 97% organ survival rate. At 10 years, we anticipate maybe an 88% organ survival rate for this particular patient based on their lab results. So this is, you know, in and of itself, a very exciting medical device. It's very robust. It was trained on over 4,000 patients. This is something that is CE marked right now. But the use for this case is that there's another manufacturer who had a medical device that aided in organ transplantation. So, you know, when submitting their device for the regulatory submission, their initial study had a 1 year follow-up on all of their patients. Instead of waiting 10 years to make their submission, they actually used the clinical decision support software. So they said, you know, within this 1 year, this is the lab results for our patients. So if we want a 5 year follow-up, we'll apply this clinical decision support software to it and say, this is what we anticipate our 5 year follow-up to be. 10 years, this is what we anticipate our 10 year follow-up to be. So it's really exciting for it to support regulatory submissions in that respect. So
that's really interesting. Yeah. That's, you know, just the potential cost savings, right, for those post-market studies, and the potential to, you know, be able to predict how well your treatment's going to work. And that is really, wow, that's very interesting and super cool.
Yeah, and to have that kind of confidence, right? This is a CE marked decision support software that is making those predictions. So we do have some confidence in that, that it'll be used. Granted, I just have to caveat that we don't know that this approach has made it through through the regulators yet. But I think it is an exciting space to watch, and it really opens up the possibility for this type of technology.
Yeah. So we've come a long way in terms of regulations and standards, but maybe this part isn't there yet. We haven't quite gotten to regulation of these in silico trials just yet. Although I do know there's a lot of talk about it.
There is. So, and I know that there's been some up and coming training for it too, through RAPS, through other spaces. So just keep an eye out. There is a buzz around in silico trials right now.
Very cool. All right. So that was a really great summary on how we see AI within the medical device and supporting our performance studies. Can you also speak a little bit about how artificial intelligence is used to support our regulatory efforts? So that kind of regulatory workflow, if you will.
Yeah, and this is great because unlike in silico trials, which I think are still up and coming, This regulatory workflow software is already here and can already be utilized, and can help your regulatory department be more efficient, be more effective. So the first one that I want to talk about is maybe making the most impact, because one of the most time-consuming tasks we see, especially for EU submissions, are those literature reviews. So these are for CERs, for PERs, when you're doing a systematic literature review. And, you know, you put your keywords into a search and you come out with 500 articles. And all of these articles need to be screened. Anything that qualifies, data needs to be extracted from, needs to be analyzed. So there's software that has been developed that is in use that we use at RQM Plus. We use Fern AI for this. It aids in article screening. So the AI will actually go through the article and make a recommendation on whether it's relevant or not, and which exclusion criteria should be applied if it deems that it's not relevant. Once we get past the screening step, it can actually go in and aid with the data extraction as well. So this is a huge time saver. I think there's a lot of potential for it to be expanded as well. So we're seeing a lot in that systematic literature review space. Building on that, there are also software programs out there that can help with misalignment between your regulatory documents. So if you maybe your device in one document is named the project name, whereas in another document it's named, you know, the marketing brand name, or there's misspellings between them, you know, little things like that. If there's maybe a few words off in your intended purpose, or a line missed out of your intended purpose, there's software out there that can red flag that for you, that can help remedy that situation and make for better alignment across documents. Because that is something that we're seeing pushback from notified bodies. Is this like, well, what is the name of your device? Is it this name or this name?
Right. So or if, there's software. If you get a question about your intended use, right, from a notified body, and then you have to update it. And now yes. You have to make sure it gets updated across everything in your tech file.
Yes.
You know, and then you might miss one, and then you're, you know, how many people have to look at it to make those changes and make sure that they're made correctly?
Yeah. It's like a document control nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a few more spaces that I've seen it in the workflow. One is programs that can help with your PMS analysis. So much like the systematic literature review, if you look into FDA's MAUDE database to look for risks on your device, that can be a nightmare. You know, it can be difficult to kind of interpret what the patient has written, if they're spelling the name of your device wrong again, or if the same entry was entered in 5 times, do you count that as one? Do you have to find the other 4 duplicates of it? So there is software out there that helps you organize that a little bit better. So it can group things by harm type, by event type. It can rectify some of that misaligned data, those misspellings, that type of thing. And it's really helpful for your PMS analysis. And then the final example I have for this, I almost hesitate to say it, or using large language models. So I want to be clear, I'm not advocating you write all of your regulatory documents with ChatGPT. I think that would be a bad
idea.
Please
don't do that.
But there are some cases where you may just need, you know, kind of a refresh on the language that you're using, right? If you are kind of stuck in the regulatory mentality, but then need to write some things for laypersons. So I'm thinking of your IFU, maybe your SSPs for self-use IVDs, maybe your consent forms for clinical trials that need to be understood by laypersons. That's something that, you know, maybe you do want to use a large language model just for a first pass. So say, you know, ChatGPT, please help me write this, you know, at a sixth grade reading level. It'll make a first pass at it. Please always read it over and make sure that the information is accurate, but it can maybe help you kind of level set as to what level you should be writing to.
Great. Okay. So we're through four of our five spaces to watch for artificial intelligence and IVDs. So what is the fifth?
So I think finally, everyone really needs to keep up to date on the global view of AI. So what is really the public opinion of AI? Are we trusting it? Are we keeping an eye on bias? So I know for something like clinical trials, we always want to aim for diversity in clinical trials. So we make sure that the IVD is performing across a wide range of populations. That's a little more critical for AI-based IVDs because you're not just testing it on a diverse group of people, you also want to train it on a diverse group of people. So you're not building in bias to the design of the IVD. Also, we need to pay attention to privacy issues. When you are manufacturing an IVD, an AI-based IVD, you want to make sure that you are adhering to HIPAA, to GDPR, to any other privacy laws around the world that countries may have. And with that comes a keener eye on cybersecurity. So know who your bad actors are. Know the techniques that they're using to break into these types of software platforms. And just be aware of what's going on globally in this space. So that was a short one.
Yeah, I think it's critically important, right? Especially with the emphasis FDA is currently placing on cybersecurity, you know, the additions to the 510K emphasis on that. So I think it's really important to point out and, you know, this is hot in the news right now. So any bad actors are going to potentially impact that public trust, right? AI that's not working appropriately. You know, we've already seen that with some of those large language models. So keeping an eye on that, I think, as you're creating these types of devices is critical. Yeah. You know, I think we had a really good discussion today. I learned a lot. I hope our listeners have as well. Some final words for everybody is that, you know, this was a very high level overview of AI and IVDs, and we'd love to continue the discussion. So if you have specific topics in this space that you're interested in, please let us know, reach out on LinkedIn or any other way. And, you know, we can keep creating content like this for you. Okay. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening and we'll see you next time. And thanks, Bethany, for all of the information.
Yeah. Thank you, Margo. Thanks, everyone.